Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is the state of democracy in Latin America. Today's episode is part of a special series on the President's Inbox about the future of democracy. In recent weeks, I've been sitting down with experts to discuss whether and where democratic governance is faltering around the world. Today's episode is the final installment in the series, which is part of the Council's Diamonstein-Spielvogel project on the future of democracy. With me to discuss the extent of democratic backsliding in Latin America is Stephen Levitsky. Steve is David Rockefeller Professor of Latin American Studies and Professor of Government at Harvard University, where he directs the David Rockefeller Center for Latin America Studies. Steve is a leading scholar on democratization and authoritarianism in Latin America, and he has written widely and well on the topic. His books include the New York Times bestseller, How Democracies Die, which he co-wrote with Daniel Ziblatt. I highly recommend it. Steve, thanks for coming on the President's Inbox.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
I want to look at what is happening politically across Latin America, but if I may, I'd like to begin with a general question for you about the health of democracy around the world. I was struck when I was reading How Democracies Die that you expressed skepticism that we are witnessing a global wave of democratic backsliding, noting quite rightly that for every Hungary or Turkey in the news that is taking an illiberal turn, there is a Sri Lanka or Tunisia that's becoming more democratic. I was just wondering to kick off the conversation whether events since the book's release have led you to change your mind about the global health of democracy?
Well, I would separate two things. There are a lot of things to be concerned about. There's much to worry about, particularly really the global balance of power. I mean, the peak era, the most favorable period in world history for democracy was undoubtedly the 1990s, the decade following the collapse of the Soviet Union, when the United States and Europe were easily the dominant military, economic, diplomatic, ideological powers in the world. And during that period, for about 10 or 15 years, democracy was the only game in town in many parts of the world, including Latin America. Those days probably inevitably are over. They're long gone. The global balance power has shifted a lot. China is obviously much more powerful than it was. Russia is much more aggressive than it was as an illiberal force. And the United States and Western Europe not only are not as self-confident, not as influential, but have serious illiberal challenges within them. And so the United States is not the democracy promoter that it was in 1995, and Europe is not the democracy promoter that it was in 1995. So there are all kinds of reasons to be worried. And there are also real threats to democracy in some of the world's biggest democracies. United States, Brazil, India. So there's a ton to be worried about. That said, if you look at the number of actual democracies in the world, it's a pretty flat line since 2000. We may arguably a little bit worse off relative to a decade ago, but the idea that there's some kind of global democratic recession or surge of authoritarianism is just not borne out by the numbers. I think it's important. It's very important to look at the overall threat, but it's also important to take the bigger picture into context. And the bigger picture is that we still are in the most democratic period in world history. Globally, we are arguably overachieving in terms of the number of democracies in the world.
Okay, so let's turn our attention to Latin America. Now, of course, there's more than two dozen countries in Latin America, so we're not going to get to talk about in each and every one of them. But perhaps you can sort of paint for us an overview of the region in terms of where you see democracy going, whether it's progressing or regressing, and then maybe we can look at some specific countries that merit further discussion.
Sure. To begin with, the big picture is still relatively positive. Like the world, Latin America, the level of democracy in Latin America has been basically a flat line over the last 20 years. Obviously, a complete loss of democracy in Nicaragua and Venezuela, but Ecuador and Bolivia have redemocratized in the last few years. And so it is maybe a slight downward trend, but generally pretty stable since about the year 2000. There's a fair amount of diversity, as there always has been. Uruguay, Costa Rica, Chile, despite its crisis, continue to be pretty viable democracies. The Andes in Central America are in much worse shape, but that's not new. They've been in pretty bad shape. There was never a time when Ecuador and Guatemala were in good shape. in terms of democracy. Understood. So it's not a huge change. The big countries in the region are the ones to watch, and they're the ones that worry me a bit, both Mexico and Brazil. In Mexico, there's a balance of power between the current government and the opposition, which is always worrisome. And Brazilians have elected really an openly authoritarian figure in Jair Bolsonaro. Two things worry me looking sort of at trends. One is that in the post-COVID era, we're almost certainly looking at some very difficult economic times and a period of fiscal scarcity where governments are likely not to have the resources to govern well. And public discontent in most of the region was quite high before the pandemic. And I think it's likely to be very high in the years to come. One thing we know about democracies is they don't do well during periods of economic downturn. And I think we're probably headed for some rough economic times. So that's worrisome. The other thing that worries me is the return of the military in many countries in the region. The military has been activated by President Bukele in El Salvador. It's become a player again in Brazilian politics, which is very worrisome. It's been mobilized by AMLO in Mexico. It played a role in the overthrow of Evo Morales in Bolivia. You saw efforts by both Congress and President Vizcarra in Peru to sort of gain the support of the military in their conflict. So I don't think we're at the brink of the military seizing power. We're not heading back to the 1970s, but we are, it seems, inching back to a place more similar to earlier periods in Latin American history where the military was sort of an arbiter of political power. It wouldn't seize power, but it had a say over who was in government. And that's after 40 very positive years in terms of establishing civilian control over the military, that's an awful step backward.
Well, let's dive into some specific countries. And if I maybe we'll do it alphabetically. And I want to start with a country, Steve, you haven't mentioned, which also happens to be a country that you have studied for much of your career, and that's Argentina. We have a government in Argentina that, I guess, in some ways harkens back to Argentina's populist path at replacing President Macri, who was sort of seen as was going to come in and finally put Argentina on the right path. That didn't work out. How would you assess sort of the politics in Argentina? Is it typical for Argentina's history, or are we seeing some significant departure, whether in a positive or negative direction?
Well, Argentina has, there's one fundamental difference in Argentina post-1983, which is that the military is out. And the most positive thing you can say about Argentine democracy over the last almost four decades is that they have established full control over the military. And there continues to be, in spite of everything, a broad consensus in the political elite and in society that the military has no place in politics. And that continues. And Argentina has that over almost all of its neighbors. And so that's a huge change. Since 83, I think there's a lot of continuity. Argentina has sunk in and out of crisis. It seemed to be very unstable. But there are a number of features that are persistent, that are consistent across Argentine democracy since 83. One is the military is out of power. Two is they're sliding in and out of crisis. Three is relative institutional weakness. If you compare Argentina to Uruguay or Chile, politicians are much, the level of corruption is higher. The level of petty is not quite the right word, but sort of small to medium-sized abuse of power, court packing, packing the state bureaucracy, politicizing state institutions, heavy-duty clientelism and patronage. That stuff remains pretty high in Argentina. It's much, much worse than Chile and Uruguay. So Argentina is, in that sense, a messier, lower quality, less well-institutionalized democracy. But that said, in spite of everything, in spite of Menem, in spite of the Kirchners, there is a line that Argentine democracy has not crossed over 40 years. Nobody steals elections. Nobody locks up their opponents. Nobody stays in power longer than they should. There are a couple of governments, Menem and I think especially Cristina Kirchner, who kind of crept up to the line, but they never crossed it. And so Argentina has slid in and out of crisis. It's had periods where governments have had too much power, in part because the opposition at times has been very, very weak in the 90s and also in the early 2000s. So you've got kind of a worrisome balance of power between Peronism and its weakened opponents. But unlike many countries in the region, unlike the Bolivarian republics, Argentina has continued to be what I would consider a fully democratic regime.
So in that sense, the democratic guardrails have held, even if many Argentines, as best I can tell from polls, are dissatisfied with democratic governance. The system is working more or less democratically.
The system is working, right.
Well, let's sort of move next door to its very powerful, large neighbor, Brazil, which is, I think it's safe to say, going through some tumultuous times. And again, it's to some extent, it's a surprise. If we were to go back a dozen years or so ago, people were talking about the great success of Brazil. Brazil. Brazil had finally achieved its potential and it was sort of unstoppable. Now we've gone through a president being impeached, another president having been charged with corruption. We have Mr. Bolsonaro, who by all accounts is a populist, not necessarily a Democrat, who's hailed the period of Brazilian dictatorship from what, 64 through 85. How do you assess what's happening in Brazil, Steve?
Well, you can look at it as a glass half empty or half full. Brazil went through a perfect storm between 2014 and 2018. And Brazil is a big, unequal, fragmented country. It's a hard country to govern. And Brazilian politicians figured it out for a while in the 90s and 2000s, but with a couple of caveats. One, it was a period of economic stability. Things were going pretty well economically. It's always easier to govern when the economy is growing. And two, a presidential democracy where the president's party maybe has 15 or 20% of the seats in Congress, and you've got 12 or 15 or 18 or 20 parties in Congress. In a country as big and messy as Brazil, it's a hard country to govern. And the formula that Brazilian politicians figured out, which worked pretty well, was double-edged. It was, you've got to build coalitions to govern, political scientists agree. Got to bring in opposition parties into the cabinet. You need to share power with other parties. We all agree. How do you do that? You do it by giving other parties a piece of the pie, a share of the state. You give them ministries. You give them control over public agencies. You may also pass out white envelopes with money. It's sort of a classic exaggerated case of you don't want to see the sausage being made. Well, Brazilians saw the sausage being made with Petrobras and Odebrecht scandals. And so you had what some have characterized as the worst corruption scandal in the history of any Western democracy. You had that at the same time that Brazil suffers one of the worst recessions in its history with the end of the commodities boom. And at the same time, people were already frustrated over a number of things, including rising levels of violence. So you have difficult times in general, plus a massive economic crisis, plus an unbelievable corruption scandal all at the same time. And that's going to shake up even the most robust of democracies. Brazil, I think, had and has a pretty robust democratic system, but this was a heck of a shock. And not surprisingly, politics polarized. Not surprisingly, anti-system or outsider politicians kind of rose to the fore. It wasn't inevitable that Bolsonaro won, but it was a pretty fertile terrain, given the level of public frustration and public anger, for him to rise up in the polls. It wasn't accidental, but it was very unfortunate that Bolsonaro faced the PT in the second round of the election. The PT, you know, for better or worse, you can assign the level of blame that you want to assign, but it was the incumbent party when the country fell into crisis. And so incumbent parties, when countries fall into the abyss, tend not to win re-election.
That seems to be a truism of democracy.
Yeah. Incumbent parties, when you suffer simultaneously the worst corruption scandal and the worst economic crisis in your modern history, that's not much to run on. And so this was a pretty easy rival for Bolsonaro to beat. And so that contributed to his victory. So it is never good for democracy when you elect somebody who is openly authoritarian. Jair Bolsonaro is very open and has been throughout his career about his sympathy for authoritarian solutions. And so anytime, I've made this argument about the United States, anytime you elect somebody with authoritarian instincts in a presidential system, you're putting your democracy in danger. Now, so far, Congress has held its ground. The judicial branch has held its ground. I think it remains to be seen what role the military will play in all of this.
Well, let me ask you about that, Steve, because at the end of last month, President Bolsonaro fired his defense minister, and that led to the heads of the military services all resigning. I take it because they disapproved of the decision. Do we have any sense? I know it's early as to how that might play out. Is this sort of the seeds of a pushback from the military as well against Mr. Bolsonaro, further undercutting his support? Again, he has terrible troubles with COVID-19. The economy last year fell. One figure I saw said 9%. Not sure how accurate that is, but obviously he has enough on his plate already. Or is this a case where he is going to be able to replace people in his administration with those who are even more willing to help him carry out his agenda?
Well, I think that's the goal. Bolsonaro is playing two games, two survival games. One, he realizes he needs to build a coalition in Congress. He largely ignored this process of building a coalition in Congress his first couple years and paid pretty dearly. Wasn't able to achieve much in Congress, despite the fact that it's a pretty conservative Congress. But he didn't invest in building a coalition, and he paid pretty dearly for it. So over the last year, he's worked harder to build alliances in Congress, and he's built an alliance with these sort of patronage-based parties that are called the central, the center parties. And part of the cabinet shift was an effort to please them. So part of what's going on is kind of typical, reasonably healthy Democratic politics. The other survival game, though, is that Bolsonaro is trying to shore up control in his alliances in the cabinet and in the military, possibly for some kind of an authoritarian power play. I think, Bolsonaro followed the events in the United States in November, December, January very closely. One of the reasons why Donald Trump's attempted autogolpe failed in the United States and was bound to fail was he had virtually zero chance of mobilizing the military behind him. And it's hard, anybody who studies Latin America knows, to carry out an autogolpe without the military.
By which you mean sort of a self-coup.
Yes, sorry, self-coup. Bolsonaro knows that. And Bolsonaro has been paying a lot of attention and thinking a lot, particularly as he has sunk in the polls. Because a few months ago, it looked like he had a pretty darn good chance every election. It's now looking, he's losing more sleep now. And polls have him neck and neck with Lula, which is terrifying for him, I think. So he is, I think, thinking about scenarios and possible scenarios to try to overturn election results or some kind of a non-democratic solution. And to do that, he needs the military. And I strongly suspect what's going on is he is searching for reliable allies in the military. And those who are pushing back, he's trying to remove. I don't think that we've seen the final act of this play yet. We don't know. There's a scenario in which Bolsonaro is successful in removing all of the obstacles and packing the military hierarchy with loyalists, with those who will go along with an authoritarian adventure. That could still happen. There's also a scenario, and I think you're right that we just saw some initial pushback with the resignations. There's a scenario in which the military says, no, that's not going to happen. I think that's what's coming in the months to come. Given that Bolsonaro has been weakened politically, given that his approval rating is, it's closer to 30 than 40, and given how disastrous the situation is, that plus the fact that the military is a pretty institutionalized, pretty professional institution, if I had to bet, I would bet on the military rather than Bolsonaro winning this struggle. But I think we don't know.
Fair enough. I'd like to go across the Andes and just talk about Chile briefly, which you earlier sort of touted as a success. I must say that caught my eye because obviously politics in Chile has been tumultuous over the last 2 years. Protests erupted over a hike of metro or subway prices, and that led to a constitutional crisis. As I understand, the constitution has been rewritten. So sort of tell me how you see this as being a success and a sign of sort of the health of Chile's democratic spirit.
Well, success, right, at the snapshot today doesn't suggest success, and success may be a little overstated. I was characterizing the last 30 years in Chile. Chile has some things that many of its neighbors don't have. It has an effective state, a bureaucracy, and a more or less effective rule of law. It is certainly not corruption-free, but it is less corrupt and less prone to patronage, clientelism, and other forms of institutional abuse than most of its neighbors. So it's got a more solid foundation for democratic politics than many of its neighbors. That said, the regime slid into a severe legitimacy crisis in 2009, as you pointed out. Massive, massive protests and public opinion signaling very clearly that the existing status quo, the existing regime, had lost legitimacy. Now, again, like in Brazil, you can kind of look at this from a glass half empty and half full standpoint. The positive take is that there wasn't a coup. The country didn't descend into anarchy or civil war or even much violence. There was some violence. But thus far, they have found an institutional solution. They've called and they're about to elect a constituent assembly to rewrite the Pinochet constitution. So if you're going to have a crisis of legitimacy, this is certainly the way out you would look for, as opposed to the military seizing power. So I think that there is at least the possibility that Chileans will find a kind of institutional way out, and there's the potential for renewing the democracy within democracy.
Well, I must say I'm struck because, again, in reading How Democracies Die, you spend some time talking about how Chilean democracy came back together under Pinochet with a sort of clear decision by people to try to find common ground and to go to what are pretty extraordinary lengths, given how most democratic societies operate, to find that common ground, given that there were some pretty deep divisions, obviously the divisions that led to the Pinochet coup, but also the consequences of that coup for politics. Is there something special in the sort of Chilean national conception that drives this, or have they just been fortunate to have people who make smarter choices?
Well, a couple of things, but there's an addendum to this story, which is a little more complicated. Chile had some advantages. It has it's an unequal society. It has a pretty small, narrow political elite, meaning these folks all know each other, went to the same schools, know each other's families. It's very different from the United States or Brazil or Peru in that sense. It has or had until recently strong political parties, which makes it easier for, a dozen or half a dozen politicians to sit down and hammer out an agreement and then go and make it stick because the parties will go along. But also, it is true that the Chilean political elites learned a lesson from the coup. Many of them were exiled for many years. They were exiled at an important time when the Cold War was winding down, the communist regimes were beginning to fall apart. And so the left and center were able to look at the mistakes of the 70s and learn. And they very self-consciously developed a different way of doing politics. Again, it was easier because they were all from the same elite and they had strong parties. But they deserve a lot of credit. Now, the addendum, though, is, and this is where democracy is a complicated thing, they put in practice this, what they call the consensus democracy, where the parties, every major issue, the parties governed in coalition. There were 2, 3, 4 parties in government. They shared power. All major policies were negotiated by the leaders of the major parties, which is exactly what political scientists say they should do. They shared power. They worked by consensus. They took multiple steps to consult one another and not polarize. The perception that eventually generated among Chileans is that these guys are a cartel whose backs are towards the people. This well-intentioned effort to create a consensus democracy by getting in a closed room, sitting around a table and hammering out solutions, that didn't look so good from the perspective of voters. Voters just saw a bunch of politicians divvying up the spoils of office and not responding to the demands of voters. And that's what got, in part, Chilean democracy in trouble over the last decade. So Chileans learned that democracy could be too polarized in the early 70s. And then they learned this decade that a democracy can be insufficiently polarized. It can be too insular and consensus oriented. Because politicians have to respond to voters.
Sounds a little bit like the Goldilocks story, sort of it's too hot, it's too cold. It's very hard to find sort of the right mix.
But it's also more dynamic. Societies enter different moments for which different political dynamics in both different institutions and different political strategies are more or less appropriate.
Let me assess what one other country, and again, or a lot of countries we could talk about, but I do want to talk about Mexico, given its size, given its proximity to the United States. You've already spoken a little bit about President López Obrador, AMLO, as he goes by his nickname. He certainly is a break from the presidents who preceded him, many of whom sort of came out of the technocratic mode and for a long time were part of the PRI, the dominant party in Mexico. He's clearly a populist and sees himself as, I guess, waging a battle against sort of dominant interests. So you could tell us a little bit about what has happened since he came to office.
It's really interesting because in some ways it resembles the United States in that by most accounts, most observers' accounts, AMLO's governed pretty badly, or certainly the results have been pretty bad. Mexico's response to the COVID crisis has been among the worst on earth. One international ranking based in France placed it second behind Brazil. The economy is in pretty terrible shape. That's not entirely AMLO's fault, but the economy is not in good shape. And AMLO has an obsession with fiscal orthodoxy. So one way in which he is not similar to other populists in the region like Hugo Chavez is he's not a big spender. He has been really orthodox and anti-Keynesian in effect.
Well, he doesn't like waste. I mean, didn't he shut down the construction of the airport outside of Mexico City because he thought it was vastly
overbloated? Yeah, he does not like waste. He doesn't like spending money. He doesn't like the loss of control that fiscal deficits or debt entail. So that has alienated the left because he hasn't governed really on the left. And it may well have hurt the economy. I'm not an economist. May well leave Mexico worse off economically. So things are objectively not good, and yet his approval rating has been almost untouched.
Why would that be the case?
He's more popular than Trump, but with his support, so his base is much bigger than Trump. But with his supporters, he seems like he cannot do wrong. And this is it's actually a pretty common phenomenon among populists, because he was elected not to necessarily fix the economy, but to give the elite a punch in the mouth and create a government that's more responsive to people. And people think that AMLO is honest, and they think he is authentic. They think he is responsive to them. And that in a sense was his mandate, and it appears that he has fulfilled that. But objectively, the performance of the government is terrible. So whether there are people who think, well, it's a matter of time before Mexicans wake up and say, Jesus, things are terrible, and his approval rating falls, it has fallen a little. But right now, there's this odd gap between objective performance and subjective evaluation of AMLO. I consider him in the Kirchner camp, in the sense that
Kirchner being the former president, so actually now current vice president in Argentina.
Yeah, either Kirchner, in the sense that he's a populist. He is happy to concentrate power. He is a polarizing figure. He is politicizing institutions. So far, there are certain lines he's not crossed. He has not shown himself to be Rafael Correa, Alberto Fujimori, or Hugo Chavez. In part, that's because Mexico's democratic institutions are a little stronger than Ecuador's or Bolivia's. But he's also a career politician who actually cut his teeth in the struggle for democracy. So
you don't see him as being opposed to democracy or anti-democratic or consciously trying to undermine Mexico's actually fairly impressive sort of embrace of democratic governance over the last 3 or 4 decades.
I'm not sure. It's not obvious to me that he poses a threat. But I always worry when there is a significant imbalance of power between the governing party and the opposition. This was true in Venezuela in the early 2000s. It was true after Fujimori, particularly after his autogolpe, self-coup in 92. It was true in Ecuador after Correa got elected. It was true under both Menem and Kirchner, where you had a strong parent's party and a weakened opposition. And that is usually a recipe for trouble. If the government has too much power and the opposition is too weak to seriously pose a threat to the government, at the very least, you get too much abuse of power, you get mistakes, and at the worst case, you get efforts to change the Constitution and perpetuate yourself in power and a slide into authoritarianism. That imbalance of power is never good. Unfortunately, that imbalance of power exists today in Mexico. The opposition parties are, both the PAN and the PRI, are broadly discredited. They're weak. Morena, thanks to AMLO, continues to be very popular.
Morena being the party that he represents.
Entirely safe when you have one dominant party. I don't think there's any danger. People talk about Morena becoming a new PRI. That's not going to happen. But in the short to medium run, AMLO's got too much power and the opposition is too weak.
Okay, I'd like to sort of change the conversation and now look at the region from the vantage point of the Oval Office. Joe Biden, as you know, has come to the presidency talking about how he wants to work with democratic countries, that he wants to reinvigorate democracy around the world. I'm not sure that the administration has sort of laid out its actual action plan for doing that. But from your vantage point, is there a role for the United States in reversing democratic backsliding to the extent it exists in Latin America? Would the United States be best advised by doing a certain set of things? Or conversely, are there things you would say, please, please, please don't do, however well-intentioned they might be, because they're likely to be counterproductive?
It's a good question. Look, I mean, even in its heyday of democracy promotion in the late 80s and 1990s, U.S. influence in the region was uneven. The United States never had a lot of say over what was going to happen in Brazil or Argentina. That little influence in the late 80s in Chile. But in South America, particularly in the bigger countries, U.S. has a voice, but it's not a dominant player. Smaller countries in Central America and the Caribbean Basin, the U.S. in the 90s had a lot of influence. I mean, turning around the stolen election in the Dominican Republic in the 90s, the failed self-coup of Jorge Serrano in Guatemala in 93, obviously the military interventions in Panama and Haiti, basically forcing the Sandinistas to democratize. U.S. influence in Central America and the Caribbean in the 90s massive and generally pretty positive in terms of democracy. The U.S. is not going to go back to having the hegemonic power that it had in 1990. But my guess is if the Biden administration wanted to, it could play a modest but very positive role in the Caribbean and Central America. Central America has experienced pretty considerable democratic backsliding in the last decade. Nicaragua is now an outright dictatorship. El Salvador is on the brink and really could fall into authoritarianism. Honduras is now what I would call a competitive authoritarian regime. And Guatemala continues to be largely a mess. These are countries where the U.S. could have some influence, and I think hopefully will. Whether we could play a role in Venezuela is trickier. That's a place where an overt U.S. role could be counterproductive. I think in the past, Maduro, in a bit like Castro many years earlier, has been able to use the specter of U.S. intervention to kind of rally the troops. So that's an area where the U.S., I think, would be well advised to work with partners, with allies, and kind of lead from behind, as Obama used to say.
Who would top your list of possible allies in this effort? Who would you want to see the United States work with?
I mean, the problem is that the region is polarized and most governments don't have a lot of credibility. So in an ideal world, if we could go back a decade when there were center-left social democratic governments with a lot of prestige in power, they would have been the best prize. I mean, Lula and Dilma Rousseff, when the PT governments were strong, would have been ideal partners. The Chilean, Uruguayan, and Brazilian governments would have been great. Today, if you look at South America, you know, the far-right governments in Colombia and Brazil are not going to be useful. The Argentines are not going to be interested. And so it's not clear. The two governments that come to mind to thinking a little bit outside the box are maybe Mexico. Mexico, AMLO was almost completely uninterested in regional leadership the first couple of years in office. There are some signs that he may be looking to get more active. Still doesn't seem like it's something that'd be very high on his agenda, but could be. He would have at least the moral authority to play a role. And the other is Cuba. I mean, I think the U.S. would be very well advised to revert its policy, go back to broadly to Obama-era policies of a rapprochement, strengthening ties. There's no reason why we can't have a minimally amicable relationship with Cuba. And if we do that, basically try to pick Cuba off and divide Cuba from Venezuela. Offer Cuba something in return for backing away from Venezuela. That's the silver bullet that I would, not that there's any silver bullet that's going to democratize Venezuela, but that's where I would start. It's a big ask. It's a tall order. But if we really want to weaken the regime in Venezuela, realigning Cuba would be critical.
On that provocative thought, which is likely to prove divisive in terms of American domestic politics.
Yes. I don't have to win the state of Florida.
Well, we're going to close the president's inbox on that note. My guest has been Stephen Levitsky, David Rockefeller Professor of Latin American Studies and Professor of Government at Harvard University and Director of Harvard's David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies. He is the co-author of the terrific book, How Democracies Die. Steve, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed on the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Zoe did double duty as our recording engineer. Thanks, Zoe. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.